Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a companion podcast to my Fox Nation special, Riddle, The Search for James R. Hoffa. Be sure to go to foxnation.com to watch the whole show. And now, Riddle, the podcast.
I cannot engage directly or indirectly in management of labor union.
Disappeared from sight here at the Marcus Red Fox restaurant. The FBI is up against the stone wall in their investigation.
Intensive investigation into his disappearances.
Police checking out anonymous tips they say cannot be ignored.
Hi, I'm Eric Schein, and welcome to Riddle, the podcast, my in-depth conversations with those involved in our Fox Nation special, Riddle, The Search for James R. Hoffa, and my Fox News reporting. Thanks for listening today. For the next 36 minutes, you'll hear from Dan Maldea. Dan is perhaps the nation's most prominent Hoffa expert. He started reporting on the Teamsters and Hoffa when he was in his early 20s. You know, he was beaten up for doing so in the process. And in 1978, he wrote the landmark book, The Hoffa Wars: Teamsters, Rebels, Politicians, and the Mob. But first, let me get you quickly up to speed. Jimmy Hoffa, he disappeared on July 30th, 1975, from the parking lot of the Marcus Red Fox restaurant in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. It was believed he was headed to a meeting with Detroit mob boss Anthony Tony Jack Jackalone and New Jersey Genovese captain and Teamster official Tony Pro Provenzano. Well, in 2001, Buffalino crime family member and Teamster official Frank Sheeran, an admitted mafia killer, he told me he shot Hoffa in a house in Detroit. I met him as part of his proposed biography, which became the book I Heard You Paint Houses. In 2004, we went to that house. We pulled up the tiles on the hardwood floor, and we actually found blood. The pattern fit Sheeran's story precisely. The greatest amount of the possible evidence was in front of the foyer closet door, where Sheeran says Hoffa hit his head on the floor. 7 drops went down the hallway to the kitchen, where Sheeran says Hoffa's body was dragged out by 2 accomplices and was cremated. The FBI did find blood. They said 1 drop was inconclusive in terms of a DNA match. Another one was to an unknown male. There was no match to Hoffa, which is why I am calling on the government to release all of the Hoffa FBI investigation files fully now. Let the Hoffa family and the American public know what's been secret for so long and that we have been denied knowing, and retest the blood evidence we found using the latest DNA technology. Here now, Dan Maldea. Dan Maldea, thank you. You have spent decades of your life covering this story. You have spent decades of your life covering the Teamsters, and you wrote the landmark book, The Hoffa Wars: Teamsters, Rebels, Politicians, and the Mob, back in 1978. Bring us back first to, you're what, a 20-something-year-old young kid, and you decide to go after and expose and investigate and report on the Teamsters.
I was 25, and I had been investigating the Teamsters for about 8 months before Hoffa disappeared. I was concentrating on the Teamsters pension fund, and then I got a call from, I had done an 8-part series for this small newspaper in Ohio, which is where I lived, and I got a call from John Quitney from the Wall Street Journal, the great investigative journalist at the Journal, and he said, listen, I read your little 8-part series about the Teamsters pension fund, and I was fascinated by it. I'm thinking about doing a 3-part series for the Journal myself. Could you help me out? And I said, of course. And so I helped John, and John came out with his piece on July 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, 3-part series. But just as with my little piece, no one really cared about the Teamsters and the Mob. But 1 week after John's series appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. And now everybody was interested in it. So John called me as soon as the news was released that Hoffa disappeared. And we came to this very, very logical conclusion that Hoffa was alive and well, and up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, at this hunting lodge owned by Alan Dorfman, who was the fiduciary manager of the Teamsters Pension Fund at one time, convicted, out of jail, close friends with Jimmy Hoffa. And so John and I flew up to Eagle River, Wisconsin, and made this very embarrassing check to discover that Hoffa was not at all there. In fact, that Alan Dorfman was in Rome at the time with a very solid alibi. So John went back to New York to take all the grief he was going to take from his colleagues at the Wall Street Journal. I went to Detroit, and all I had was a credit card and a gas card or something like that in my wallet. And I grabbed a cab, and I went to the Red Fox restaurant where Hoffa was last seen. And when I walked in, I saw Irving R. Levine, the great economics labor reporter for NBC News, walk by, and he went down to a phone bank. And I went down to him, and I was looking at him, and he was looking at me, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "You need me." And he says, "I need you. What do I need you for?" And he says, "You need me for the Hoffa disappearance, because that's why you're here in Detroit." And he says, "You know something about the case?" And I said, I know whatever you need to know about the Teamsters and the mob." And he said, "Are you that graduate student from Kent State who was working with Quitney?" And I said, "That's me." And he said, "What do you do it for lunch?" So I wound up working with NBC News from day one, really, when this thing was announced. And at the first thing I went to was I got a source who told me about this goon squad that was running around shaking down trucking companies, and that a portion of this goon squad, which was run by a guy named Roland McMaster, who was very close to Hoffa at one time but then had a very big falling out with him. And at the time Hoffa disappeared, Roland McMaster was at war with Jimmy Hoffa. And in fact, there had been this series of acts of violence in local 299, Hoffa's home local in Detroit, which I received information about that McMaster was behind. And I came to a very logical conclusion that whoever was behind the local 299 violence was behind Hoffa's murder. And then when it became clear that that Hoffa's guys were in fact behind the bombing of Dick Fitzsimmons' car, the bombing of Dave Johnson's cabin cruiser,
Dick Fitzsimmons. Let me just point out Fitzsimmons, who went on to become head of the Teamsters.
Fred Fitzsimmons was at the time the head of the Teamsters Union, and he was Hoffa's handpicked successor. But Hoffa was a centralist when he was as president of the Teamsters Union. He liked to centralize power in his own hands, whereas when he went to jail and wound up giving up the presidency in 1971, where Frank Fitzsimmons took over, Fitzsimmons started to decentralize the union. And so the local mob had all this jurisdiction within their own little fiefdoms around the country, and they liked Fitzsimmons because they liked that decentralized power. And so as a consequence of that, they wanted to keep Hoffa out of power. They wanted to show him respect, but they wanted to keep him out of power. They liked Fitzsimmons' brand of management. And so they wound up backing Fitzsimmons, and when Hoffa tried to get back into the union, which he was shut out from, and Hoffa had no chance of getting back as president of the Teamsters Union, and he felt double-crossed by some people, and so he started talking. He was talking to grand juries in Detroit. He was talking to congressional committees in Washington. He was talking to journalists. He did a big interview with Jerry Stanicky, the great reporter from WXYZ-TV in Detroit for Playboy magazine, in which he was throwing all kinds of accusations around. And I think as a consequence of him talking and shooting his mouth off, I think the decision made that it was time to eliminate Jimmy Hoffa. And that was the scene before a very important informant stepped forward, and his name was Ralph Picardo. And the fruits of Picardo's information came forward in December of 1975. And what had happened was Steve Andrena, one of the alleged co-conspirators in Hoffa's murder, had allegedly gone to see Picardo, who was in prison for 20-some years for a manslaughter conviction. And Picardo was a former driver for Tony Provenzano, so he was very familiar with the Andrettas and Sal and Gabe Bergoglio, who were the other alleged co-conspirators, among others. And and during this alleged prison visitation, Steve allegedly gave Picardo some information about what had happened to Jimmy Hoffa a few days earlier.
And that was the basis for...
And that was the basis for, as far as I'm
FBI?
Concerned, everything that has happened since. I believe Ralph Picardo is the key overall witness in the case, and he was told that Hoffa was murdered. He presumed, but he was not sure, but he presumed, based on his experience with the Provenzano crowd and the fact that Sal Bergoglio had been contracted to kill Hoffa once before, that it was Sal Bergoglio who had done the murder himself. But see, Andretta did not tell him that. What Andretta did tell him was that Hoffa was put into, after his murder, he was put into a 55-gallon drum. He was loaded onto a Gateway transportation truck, and he was shipped to New Jersey, where he was buried. And that is what was known coming out of Picardo. So as a consequence, in early December of 1975, Sal Bergoglio, Gabe Bergoglio, Steve Andretta, Tom Andretta were brought before the grand jury, along with Roland McMaster, along with, as I understand it, Frank Sheeran, and others. But we were not hit. Frank Sheeran was not on our radar screen at that time. We did not know about Frank Sheeran at that time. He was under our radar screen, and then the Hoffax memo came out in January 1976, a month later, but none of us had any access to that until much later.
That has the suspects, and we've reported that. It lists those that you mentioned, as well as Frank Sheeran.
Including McMaster, who I believed was... My position on McMaster was that he was responsible for the disposal of the body. On the day of the murder, he and his brother-in-law were with Gateway officials with an alibi. His brother-in-law, Stan Barr, was the head of the Gateway Steel Division in Detroit. And again, it was consistent with the information that Picardo was giving. So I focused my investigation on McMaster, who I had focused on since day one after Hoffa disappeared, but then I expanded it to the Bergoglios and the Andrettas, all of whom I interviewed exclusively on October 25th, 1976.
Let me stop you right there. That is unbelievable. You have met these suspects. The only one that we believe is alive of the major suspects, well, two, Chucky O'Brien, who was close to the Hoffa family, and Thomas Andretta. Both pled, took the fifth in the grand jury. Chucky O'Brien has denied publicly involvement. We have reached out to both. They do not, while Chucky O'Brien doesn't want to talk, we have not heard so far from Mr. Andretta, who's still alive in his early 80s in Las Vegas. Tell me about the suspects.
What had happened was I was approached to do a pull-together story on the Hoffa grand jury, the one-year anniversary of the Hoffa grand jury. And so I was in New Jersey with a partner who was going to write the story with me, and I decided to pick up the phone and call Sal Bergoglio. So I called Sal Bergoglio up at the Union Hall, and he said, what do you want to talk about? And I said, I want to talk about the Hoffa disappearance, Mr. Bergoglio. And he said, well, what the hell do you think that I have anything to say about that? And I said, because, Mr. Bergoglio, you've neither been arrested nor indicted, and yet everyone is blaming you for this murder, and I think the government might be violating your civil rights. Well, I've never met a mafia guy who's not against wiretapping. I've never met a mafia guy who's not in favor of strong personal privacy laws. And I've been bored for hours by mob guys whining about the alleged impingements upon their rights and freedoms by the FBI and the IRS. And so Sal Bergoglio said to me, Dan, come on up. So I went up to Local 560, and I was sitting in the waiting room. And then Sal Bergoglio comes to the door along with Bill Buffalino, who was his attorney from Detroit. Bill Buffalino was representing everybody. So he said, you want to have lunch with us? And I said, sure. And so we went down. We got into Bergoglio's car. He pressed a button. It opened up the garage at Local 560. We went across the street. Literally, we drove across the street. There was a restaurant there. We went in. We went to the back room, and there was Gabe Bergoglio there. So the three of us had lunch. The four of us had lunch. The Bergoglio brothers, Bill Buffalino, and me. And he said, let's go back to the Union Hall. We can do this interview. So we went back, and I'm sorry, Steve Andretta was with us too. Steve Andretta was there with Gabe Bergoglio. So it was, the scene at the restaurant was Bergoglio and I and Bill Buffalino walked in, and we saw Steve Andretta and Gabe Bergoglio sitting at the table. So it was the five of us who had lunch together. And then after lunch, we went back to the Union Hall, And Sammy Provenzano, Tony Provenzano's brother, who was president of Local 560 at the time, joined us. Tom Andretta couldn't make it, but they put me on the phone with him while we were having our conversation.
What did he say?
Well, everybody denied everything. I think that but they were giving me different answers as to where they were at that time. Also, I had really never thought that Russell Bufalino was at the epicenter of this thing. It was they who called my attention to Bill Bufalino. Steve Andretta told me about, I did not understand how Picardo had gotten his information.
You mean to Russell?
Andretta explained it to me. I mean, in his denial, he explained it to me. I did not understand how Sal Bergoglio got put into the trick bag until he explained it to me. Now, they denied any participation. In fact, Bill Bufalino wound up blaming the CIA for killing Jimmy Hoffa. But it was a 3.5-hour interview on tape.
What were they like?
You know, nice guys. I mean, you know, what can I say? I think Bergoglio was a little skeptical of me, but he was the one I ended up getting along with best. I had one subsequent conversation with Steve Andretta, and then I had, I think, three or four subsequent conversations with Sal Bergoglio, leading it right up to the month before I was murdered.
That was in 1978 in Mulberry Street in Little Italy. I mean,
He was murdered on March 21st, I think. It was March 21st, 1978. And my last conversation with him was mid-February of 1978, like about a month earlier. He was clearly tired and weary, and he was clearly scared, and he was clearly upset. And I didn't sense that he was thinking about flipping or anything like that, which was the allegation. And I had never heard that Sal Bergoglio was even considering flipping, but I think that somebody had just decided, why take a chance with this guy? And so they decided to eliminate him from the scene.
What do you think, or did you buy anything that they were telling you? I mean, would you thread the needle? How would you put it together?
Well, I went there to talk about their civil rights being violated. I did. After we got through all of that, then we started getting down to the nitty-gritty of the Hoffa case and where they were and what they were doing. And all of them claimed to have been in New Jersey at that time. I think that the Hoffa murder was a three-act drama with different characters in each act. I think the overall key witness in the Hoffa murder is Ralph Picardo and continues to be. I think with regard to characters and everything else, he is still the key guy. With regard to Act One, the pickup of Hoffa, I think that Frank Sheeran's version of events is as good as anything I've heard. I know as a fact that the key to me is his flying over the Lake Erie from Port Clinton, Ohio, to the Pontiac Airport. The Pontiac Airport to me was key because I had long had information, and I wrote the Hoffa Wars. You know, I published the Hoffa Wars 26 years before Sheeran's memoir came out. But I had, in the book, I was talking about Pontiac Airport and that McMaster had picked up Tony Provenzano at the Pontiac Airport on very close to the time of Hoffa's murder, either the day before, like the day before or the day of. And so Act One, with Frank Sheeran's explanation of how he came to come to Detroit, that made sense to me. I was so impressed with it. When you first broke the story of Charlie's book back in 2004. And I said at that time, I said, you know, I think that Sheeran's story is the most important break in the case since Hoffa disappeared. It's just that I don't believe that he was the one who killed Jimmy Hoffa. And so then Act Two is the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. I do not believe Frank Sheeran's story about that. Not at all. I think Sheeran was the one who lured him into the car. I think Hoffa would have gotten into a car with Sheeran, but at the same time, I do not believe that Sheeran is correct on the people he says who were in the car. I believe that Vito Giacalone, who was the brother of Tony Giacalone, who, along with Tony Provenzano, were two of the mob guys that Hoffa was supposed to meet at the Red Fox that day. I think Vito Giacalone was in the car. I think he, and I have been told that from somebody I believe was a direct participant in all of this.
Yeah, in our show, Riddle, Keith Corbett, who's the former head of the Organized Crime Strike Force, believes that.
Well, I think Vito's key in this whole thing, and really he has I think all of us have sort of missed that boat. Like I said, I've been talking about it since the 50th since the 40th anniversary in 75, in 2015. So in part two, the murder of the body, my key witness on that is a guy named Don Wells. And Don Wells, whom I have interviewed, was the key source for the 2006 dig in Milford Township, Michigan.
And can you explain who he was or is?
Don Wells was very close to Roland McMaster, whom I had suspected of being behind the disposal of Hoffa's body from the outset, from day one, after my initial source called me while I was on my first day with NBC News. Don Wells was in prison at the time, and he told the FBI about what he thought was Hoffa's burial. And so we weren't being given very much information, and the FBI was not releasing the search warrant upon which it based its dig. They did an excavation of this farm, which had been owned by Roland McMaster at the time. And they did not release a search warrant, so we didn't know the details of it. And the details that were coming out were kind of funny, kind of unbelievable. So I went to Wells, whom I had interviewed back in 1976, because he was so close to McMaster. And I talked about him in the Hoffa Wars, in fact. And, I mean, like, you know, 40 years before he became famous. And Wells told me that basically, you know, here was the situation. He was with Tony Provenzano and Roland McMaster the night before the murder. He believed that Tony Provenzano was actually present at the scene of the murder, which is consistent with what the FBI had been saying, was that Steve Andretta was in New Jersey at the time of the murder, giving Tony Provenzano the alibi that he desperately needed. Remember, they put Steve Andretta into prison for contempt because he refused to testify about his whereabouts, specific whereabouts, on that day. And so I believe that Tony Provenzano was not only in Detroit the night before the murder, as Don says, because Don was with him, but I believe that he, along with McMaster and Stan Barr, the head of Gateway Transportation, I believe that Tony Provenzano was actually present for the murder. And I believe that the murder took place in either one of two places. I think it either took place on that farm, or I believe that it took place at McMaster's home, which was literally 5 minutes away from the Red Fox restaurant.
As the FBI, have they investigated that home?
The FBI were the ones that took me to the home.
Okay.
They were the ones that took it to me back in 1976. They said, here, we want you to know this. I mean, you'll see, even in the Hoffa files, you'll see a lot of reports about me in there because I was a freelance writer. I had received money from the Hoffa Reward Fund from Jimmy Hoffa Jr., and then I joined the Free Press, and then I became, you know, part of the world of journalism at that point after I had left NBC. NBC wanted me to stay and just start doing research on general assignment stories. Like I said, I was a kid at the time. I was 25 and in 1975. But I wanted to stay on the Hoffa case. Mm-hmm. I really thought that I had something going here with this McMaster thing. And so I stayed. I developed sources in the FBI. The FBI had done a couple of reports about my information about McMaster and his goon squad. And so it led then to what I believe happened in Act 3, and that's the disposal of the body. Once again, Picardo had said that Hoffa's body was stuffed into a 55-gallon drum, loaded onto a Gateway transportation truck, and shipped to an unknown destination in New Jersey. Why keep the body intact? Why move it to New Jersey? Because, as it's been explained to me, the Provenzano people wanted to keep the body. They wanted to keep it. The reason was, you keep the body as a get-out-of-jail-free card. You've been indicted for murder. You're facing some serious charges or something like that, and you want a deal. And they say, "What do you have to bargain with? I can give you Jimmy Hoffa's body."
Where do you think it went?
Well, the FBI questioned Picardo strenuously about that, and they said, based on your experiences, based on your relationships and associations with the Provenzano crowd, where would they take the body? And Picardo replied that they would take it to a landfill in Jersey City called Brother Moscato's Dump. And it was run by a guy named Phil Moscato, who was an alleged associate of the Genovese crime family, very, very close to Tony Provenzano, the best friend of Sal Berguglio. And so I was doing a story years later on a payoff that a federal judge had received from some mafia guys. And the mafia guy who was the alleged bag man, the payoff man, was Phil Moscato. And I said, I know who this guy is. This is the guy from the Hoffa case. So I picked up the phone. I called Moscato. I wanted to interview him about this corrupt judge. And so he said, you know, he talked to me on the phone. And I said, may I come and see you? And he said, sure. So I drove up to New Jersey, and I went to go see Phil Moscato, the Phil Moscato, Moscato's Dump. And I had my tape recorder on, and we were talking. And I said, you know, the first time I heard about you was about the Hoffa case. And he said, well, I was there at that grand jury in early December 1975. I said, you were there? He says, yeah. I said, did you take the fifth like everybody else? He said, of course I did. Everybody took the fifth. I said, well, tell me how it happened. And the tape recorder is on the table. We are listening to the tape. And Moscato tells me, in no uncertain terms, that he and Sal Berguglio had buried the body.
Mm. Did he say
and
where?
So, I'm a little unclear about that.
Okay.
A little unclear about where. Phil was very good to me. He never asked me for anything. But he gave me information at the rate that a kosher butcher would give out pork sausages. He was a tight-lipped guy, and my relationship with Phil lasted for like about 7 years while I was trying to drag things out of him. You know, my last meeting with him, before he died, I told him I wasn't going to reveal any of this information until after he was gone, because he was very sick at the time when I first met him in 2007. He ended up living for 7 years and he died in 2014. But then in 2015, in my 50th anniversary story about the case, I then revealed what he had told me, and it was Moscato who told me that Vito Giacalone was a key guy in the case. And I asked him specifically about Frank Sheeran. I said, tell me about Frank Sheeran. And he said Frank Sheeran was nowhere to be found on this case. I said, what do you mean by that? He said Frank Sheeran had nothing to do with the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. And I asked him about whether he was the guy who lured him into the car, as I had believed when I first learned about Sheeran back in, I guess it was in the fall of 1977. And I called Sheeran and I talked to him. He didn't tell me anything. You know, he lied to me, of course. But I was trying to figure out exactly what the role of Sheeran was, and Moscato would only tell me he was not involved in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. He says, I'm not gonna say anything about my best friend Sal Berguglio. You draw whatever conclusions you want about that. But Frank Sheeran had nothing to do with this.
Your view is that it was Sal Berguglio who was the shooter. The house on Beaverland and the blood pattern that we found, as you know, there were 50 samples. The FBI found 28 were blood. They were only able to get DNA from two, one an unknown male, another inconclusive. What does that tell you, and what does that tell you about Sheeran telling me he was the shooter? And
I believe that Sheeran was knowledgeable about this. I believed that he was an eyewitness to the murder. Remember, Sheeran, I had alleged that Sheeran was involved in the murder in the Hoffa Wars in 1978, 26 years before his memoir came out, and I was very appreciative of the fact that Charlie and Sheeran were as kind to me as they were in their book, saying pretty nice things about me, because I knew I was out there on this thing. I mean, I was out there sticking my neck out all over the place on this case as an independent without any protection whatsoever. And so I appreciated that, but I understood the reason why Frank had stepped up. It had nothing to do with honesty. He had lost his book contract. He had been saying that Sal Berguglio was the killer from pretty much when he started talking about this thing, when he was telling the story about this was a Vietnamese hit team who had been involved in this thing. I mean, you know, Sheeran was doing another book with another author, John Seitz. And John Zeiss wasn't a professional writer, and he certainly wasn't a professional man as Charlie Brand is. And I am second to none in my admiration for Charlie for what he was able to drag out of Sheeran. But to me, this was all about money. It was from the beginning. You know, it was suspect to me. Plus the information. John Zeiss, before he died, he gave me everything that he has, including the videos about what Sheeran said. And I can assure you there are multiple inconsistencies between what Sheeran said back then and what he said later on when the money was on the table.
When I met him, he was blunt and he was direct about it. Then how would you explain the blood pattern in the exact pattern that
he knew if in fact the murder was there at that place, then he knew it was there at that place when Sal Bergoglio killed him. That's the way I would describe it. Also, he has been inconsistent whether he shot him with once or twice. He's been inconsistent about that. I have.
No, he said twice with me.
He says twice, but I have him saying once.
Okay. So your position is that Sal Bergoglio was the shooter.
Absolutely. No ands, ifs, or buts about it, yeah.
If the FBI, you talk about the FBI files, is it your view that they should be released unredacted? There are thousands of pages, heavily redacted. The FBI has not released them. Should the government release everything so you can find out about the informants, find out about what they claim, find out about the different stories, and so the truth can come out?
Well, David Ashenfelter had done an FOIA along with Barbara Kranzer, Hoffa's daughter, to the FBI. They were able to get 17,000 documents, as I recall, 5,000 of which were unredacted. And when David Ashenfelter received, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Detroit Free Press, received the information, he gave one set of the files. He got three sets. He gave one, kept one for himself. He gave one to Barbara, and he gave one to me. I've gone through the 5,000 unredacted files, and they are amazing. No ands, ifs, or buts about it. There's a lot of good stuff in it, but nothing breathtaking, nothing earth-shaking, nothing that somebody who knows a lot about this case is going to be shocked by. It does concern me that some sources are named in there who could be at risk, even at this late date. Also, with regard to the unredacted, there are several pages in there. I would like to see the full, the full unredacted version of it. The Hoffax report is redacted. I have the unredacted version. I'm sure you do you have the unredacted version?
Yeah, I do. We have the unredacted version.
The unredacted, even the section on McMaster?
I have to go look at it again. There is
even on the unredacted version of the Hoffax report, the section on McMaster is redacted.
So is it your view that all this should come out?
Absolutely. I would say you have to protect sources, no ands, ifs, or buts about it. Confidential sources, people who gave information to the Bureau, especially those still alive who
How many are there?
With the understanding of confidentiality and non-disclosure.
Yeah, understandable. How many are still alive? I mean, there may not be that many at all, if at all.
Well, again, it'd be a case-by-case basis situation. I don't know that, I still believe, I believe in my heart of hearts that this case will be solved. I still believe it. I allow myself every 10 years to be conned by somebody who has a new and hot lead about this case. I got conned in 2009 by somebody who, it was a very logical progression of events. Cast of characters was right. The people were right. The situation was right. And I spent 2 weeks looking at this. I don't know what this guy got out of this. I mean, but I was into this for almost 2 weeks where I was trying to, I thought that in the end I was actually going to get Hoffa's body. And I'm in the midst of a situation right now where I have been given, and this is a Jersey lead, this is in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
I have been given a very, very good situation, which I'm now jumping through all kinds of hoops right now in order to do it. But I consider myself to be Ahab and the Hoffa case to be my white whale.
What?
It is important for me to. There is no justice in this world if I'm not at the denouement of this of the situation in the end.
Dan, what do you think it'll take? Will it take the release of all the files unredacted? Will it take retesting the DNA on the blood evidence that we found in the house?
I think the DNA, I think what you, the extraordinary thing that you and Charlie and Ed Barnes and, you know, other great reporters did with regard to, you know, really doing some tremendous detective work and doing what you did at the Beaverland House, I think that has to be followed up to the max. You know, I think that to everyone's satisfaction.
So retest the DNA.
Is this Hoffa's blood or not? You have the DNA from Hoffa's hairbrush to match with whatever blood is found, and it is important, I think, that this be done. With regard to the files, there are certain files that are important, certain files that are not. And
what's the most important one to you that should be released?
Well, the most important ones are the ones who are the information about Roland McMaster, the information about Frank Sheeran, the information about the Verguglios, the information about the Andrettas, the information about Picardo, the information about the Moscato, the information about those who were named in the Hoffex report as the top suspects, as well as some of their underlings, like in McMaster's case, Larry McHenry and Jim Shaw, who were two of his goons, whom I had been told by my source on the first day that I was on the Hoffa case for NBC, whom I was told were behind the bombing of Dick Fitzsimmons' car 20 days before Hoffa disappeared. Like I said, I believe that if you found out who was behind the violence in Local 299 before Hoffa disappeared, and I interviewed every single one of the victims of those acts of violence, no one was killed, but everyone was, you know, either they lost property or they were injured themselves. I mean, George Roxborough got shot in the face with a shotgun and survived. And so I believe that all that information should come out as well. I would love to see all of that information. So with regard to what you were trying to do, Eric, trying to get the DNA once and for all determine whether this is Hoffa's blood, I completely support that. I think that should be done to everyone's satisfaction. And number two, with regard to the release of the files, again, with certain discretion, appreciating the identity of certain key informants to make sure they're not placed at risk. Yeah, I'm totally in favor of bringing all of that information out.
Yeah, us too, and that's our call. And finally, Dan, you have lived with this for so long. What has this whole journey been like for you? Every time there's something new, you are so deep in it, and you have the unbelievable distinction of actually sitting down and meeting with the suspects.
And taping them for 3.5 hours, yeah, and having them on tape for 3.5 hours. It's not like this has been my whole life. I mean, I've done, you know, 9 books, you know, about ready to release my 10th, which has absolutely nothing to do with any of this stuff. It has been an interesting journey, let's say. But I'm going to consider this if I'm on my deathbed, I'm going to consider this one of my great failings that I was able to solve this case, because I have people come up with me saying, hey, I heard that Jimmy Hoffa's body is in the basement of the White House. Well, you know, sad for me, that's as good as anything I've come up with so far. And so, I think this case needs to be solved. This is a situation, Eric, where a very, very infamous person, Jimmy Hoffa, who my view is a real anti-hero, a real villain, but very recognizable, very famous, a person was snatched from a public place in broad daylight and was never seen again. To me, that is a case, no matter what the cost, that has to be solved once and for all. This is the biggest hit in mob history, and this needs to be solved. And I plan to be trying to solve that murder until, you know, the day I kick.
Dan Moldea, spectacular work all these years. My admiration. And
right,
thanks.
Keep up the good work.
And respect, as you know. And the book, fascinating. Published in 1978, but it is still relevant to today. The Hoffa Wars, Teamsters, Rebels, Politicians, and the Mob. It's all in there. Dan Moldea. Dan, as always, my thanks.
Pleasure, Eric.
Thanks for listening today. Check out all the other Riddle podcasts. You can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. And just Google my name, put Frank Sheeran next to it or Jimmy Hoffa, and you can see the other articles we've written, and you can keep up with my reporting on Fox News. I'm Eric Schoen. Thanks again for Riddle, the podcast.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.